This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Franciscan Health is working in a national study that is being spearheaded by the Mayo Clinic to look into how effective what is called convalescent plasma is in trying to treat patients who've been infected with COVID-19. We have with us Dr. Erica Kaufman-West, who's the infectious disease specialist for Franciscan Health, to talk about it. And Dr. Kaufman-West, thank you for being with us today.
You're quite welcome.
Well, first, for people that do not know what convalescent plasma is, how important is it, especially in these days with COVID-19?
Our plasma in general is filled with antibodies and other valuable proteins that our body creates in order to fight off various illnesses that we come in contact with. The notion of convalescent plasma is not a new one. It's been around for a couple hundred years, and the idea is if you take someone's antibodies that's already been exposed to a disease and give them to somebody who's suffering from that disease, that those antibodies can neutralize the infection while that allowing that person to recover faster.
Mm-hmm. Now, does the FDA recognize convalescent plasma as something that can help? Maybe, I guess, part of the just to see if it will probably work in this instance, but probably in other infectious instances too?
This particular study did get, did go through the FDA as a sort of a new investigational treatment. Mm-hmm. So the FDA is aware of the notion of convalescent plasma. Up until this point, this is, to my knowledge, the largest sort of single registry looking at convalescent plasma. Up until now, it had sort of been smaller, individualized institutions sort of doing their own little pieces to mm-hmm. see if this might work against other viruses, such as H1N1 in the past or the, first SARS epidemic in the early 2000s. So it's not a new notion to the FDA, but this sort of grand scale is definitely new.
Now, we should mention that the point is that if you have gone through being a patient or at least having received a treatment of some type, or if you have actually contracted COVID-19, if you've recovered from it, you've got, of course, the antibodies in your body, I guess, that will certainly show themselves eventually. But the plasma is still good. And, in fact, any blood that is received is still going to be good. We'll talk about on how to be able to donate plasma in just a moment, but what are the ways that taking advantage of this plasma are to researchers like yourselves and others working on this particular project to see if it will indeed do what you hope it will?
Yeah, so I mean, there's so many questions that this can help us answer. The first question, obviously, is can antibodies to the SARS-CoV-2 virus, can antibodies to that virus neutralize the virus? And that's something that we all hope is the case. That would lead us to believe there's some sort of immunity that one would get from having been infected by the virus. So, that'll be the first question is can these antibodies neutralize the virus?
Mm-hmm.
The second question is what does that mean? Does it help people to avoid those severe cases, keep people off the ventilator, keep people from dying? Does it decrease the length of time that they're suffering from their illness? So do they get out of the hospital faster? Are they back to their typical routines faster? And then the question will be, at what point is this treatment best given? Is it best given in the first 72 hours? Can it still be effective after 2 or 3 weeks of illness? And then who benefits most? Is it young people, old people, people of different races or genders? Is it more effective if you've got comorbidities, for example? Or are those people the ones that are going to benefit most? So the benefit of a study this size is you'll have the sort of diversity of patients to be able to look at all of those factors and say, okay, who in the future would we prioritize this therapy to? Obviously, we are very much indebted to folks who are generous enough to donate their plasma.
Mm-hmm.
So at least at this point, this is not something that we can just make in a lab and pump out and just create as many doses as we want.
Yeah.
So knowing that there will be a limited supply, who is going to be benefiting most from it, that is hopefully questions that will be answered.
Now, obviously, getting the plasma from one's blood system starts out with donating blood. What is the difference, by the way, for folks that may not be familiar with just donating blood at the blood center and the plasma being taken about and used in this particular project?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when you donate blood, you donate everything. You donate your platelets, your plasma, your red blood cells, the whole thing. We typically think of blood donation as being a red blood cell donation, and that's the majority of what is used and what benefits people.
Mm-hmm.
But all of those other components of the blood are sort of pooled together and can be used as needed. When you're talking about donating plasma, the red blood cells are given back to the donor, and just the plasma is taken. So the idea is similar. It takes a little bit longer because they, you know, have to give you your red blood cells back. But if you've ever given blood before, it won't be that different of an experience.
I see. What's in this case? This any special requirements that you have to follow aside from the usual ones for donating blood?
Mm-hmm. No, just the usual ones of donating blood. You have to obviously know that you were infected with SARS-CoV-2. So obviously, in this case, when we're talking about plasma donation, we want people that have antibodies. So you have to have had a test that's positive at least 14 days prior. You have to be feeling well. We don't want anybody that's sick coming in. You have to be feeling well and at least 14 days past the date of your test. And then just the general, you know, standard blood donation requirements. Obviously stay hydrated on the day of your donation, just like you would with a regular blood cell.
Now, I know that Vercidi is the Franciscan Health's blood supplier, so I'm guessing that you'd have to get in touch with them to set up an appointment to be able to donate?
Yes, that's exactly right. Vercidi has on their website a whole lot of information about donating plasma and what it takes and how to do that. The Franciscan website, I'm sure you'll be able to get that information to folks, has a step-by-step process so that we can, especially if you've gotten your COVID test with us, we'll be able to help validate that with Vercidi and make it even easier for you to get to the donation center. Mm-hmm. How long will it run sort of depends on what the Mayo Clinic finds. So they did an initial analysis for safety, and they found that there were no increased adverse events or anything that would cause them to stop the study early. I don't know that they have a predefined, you know, number of patients that where they would stop the study. My understanding is that they'll continue to enroll and analyze the data at a certain point to see if they can answer some of those questions that we went through already.
Dr. Erica Kaufman-West is an infectious disease specialist for Franciscan Health here in Northwest Indiana. And thank you very much, Dr. Kaufman-West, for the information. And we hope that folks donate their blood and are able to take advantage of this national study to find out what benefits the convalescent plasma might have in dealing with COVID-19.
Thank you, and thanks for highlighting our important work.
Well, the June 2nd primary election here in Indiana was a remarkable one because not only of the pandemic, but also because of the vote-by-mail situation that everybody in Indiana was able to take advantage of for at least that election. Let's find out about the impact that the June 2nd elections had on another segment of the voting public, and we're talking about the public school referenda. Purdue University agricultural economist Larry DeBoer is one of our frequent guests. So we talk about these issues, especially involving with the school referendum. It's one of his areas of expertise, and he is with us from West Lafayette. And as always, Larry, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you, Chris.
Well, what's your assessment on how the June 2nd primary election went as far as the school referenda questions are concerned?
Well, it was a surprise to me. That 16 out of 18 referenda passed, and a surprise on a couple of scores. One was that we'd seen a trend towards less success over the last three elections. We can get the numbers here. We had a trend where 80 to 90% were passing between May 2016 and May 2018. So that was five elections in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the last three, it was 67%, 60%, and then 54% in November of 2019. And here we had 89%. And so it kind of reversed a downward trend. And then, hey, we're in a recession, for goodness sakes. And one would guess that even people who look favorably on public education and paying more for public education might have said, well, yeah, I support the referendum, but not now. But no, that's not what happened at all. The recession didn't seem to make any difference at all.
We have, of course, not only the question of the pandemic, but we also had, in some cases, two counties, Lake and St. Joseph counties, that had to deal with the impact of lifting the property tax caps. Was that a surprise to see that things did as well, even with those two counties?
Well, you know, it's been kind of a mixed bag for those counties, and a number of school corporations in Lake, which simply has a lot of school corporations compared to St. Joe County. Some of them succeeded and some of them have not, but in a surprise in the sense that both Hanover and South Bend asked for two.
Yeah.
Hanover was asking in total for more than a dollar additional rate. And boy, that's a big ask. South Bend was asking for about 40 cents altogether. And they both passed. They both passed with fairly good margins.
Tell us a little about not only here in Northwest Indiana, but around the rest of the state. There weren't a lot of, I guess, referendum questions. There were some out there. I'm sure that they probably varied. We had, of course, as we mentioned here in the Hanover Community Schools, two different questions on two different very important issues. And in the Union Township in Porter County, they only had one question, but it was pretty important for them. Did it seem to be a case where in other school districts that asked for assistance from the voters this past election that it was about the same thing? Did they ask for at least one or two things, or pretty consistent?
Well, we had four school corporations that asked for two, and they all passed. And one regularity over the last 12 years since the referendum process really got going is that there's never been a split decision. If you ask for two, they either both pass or they both fail, and that held true once again. So we had those four school corporations doing that, and everybody else asked for one. Altogether, there were five capital projects referendums and 13 operating referendums. The two that failed were Crothersville in Jackson County down south and New Albany Floyd way down on the river.
Right.
And those were both, one was an operating referendum and one was one of these new school safety and security referendums that failed. But Union won. They won with 81% of the vote. And that is also a trend that we've seen over the years. And that is that relatively small school corporations tend to have more success than everybody else. And while Union is not, under 1,000 like several of them were, that's still a fairly small school corporation, but winning with 81% voting yes. We saw Eminence over Morgan County down in the Indianapolis Donut win with 80%, and they've got an enrollment of 369 students altogether. And that's the sort of thing that we've seen over the years.
That's very teeny when you think about it, especially when you go around the state of Indiana. A lot of them don't have school districts that are that small, I would imagine.
No, it's pretty exceptional. The median school corporation, the one in the middle of the 289, is about 1,800.
Mm-hmm.
An awful lot of the ones in Lake County are bigger than that. But 1,800 is standard. And there may be 30 or so school corporations with under 1,000 in enrollment.
Are we finding, in particular, this particular election, because it's so unusual with the pandemic and more vote by mail, that we are seeing more people that took advantage of that absentee ballot to be able to make their decision? They feel more comfortable than maybe going to the polling place and having to cast a vote one way or the other for a school referendum?
Well, you wonder about that. You know, that comes down to the May versus November turnout question. It didn't look to me like mail voting, voting by mail, made that much difference in total turnout. It meant that, you know, turnout could stay up even with the danger of going out and voting when you eliminate that with mail, voting by mail. Turnout in November will certainly be much, much higher. And historically, November referenda pass less frequently than May and now June referenda. And so that seems to have held this time. Last November, just over half of the referenda passed. This time we had almost 90%.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that has been the question that we've talked about that in past conversations about whether there will be a push for getting away from the spring referenda questions in that particular election and moving them all towards November. And I don't think there's any real push for it right now, I would imagine, especially if you've had so many successful times in the spring.
Well, it's been proposed, and of course the suspicion on the part of the school corporations is that the legislators who wish that some of these wouldn't pass so frequently want to hold them just in November. And I don't know what's in folks' minds. One could also argue that since turnout is greater in November, it's more appropriate to have a vote with more people participating. So there's an argument about that, and I imagine we'll see bills asking for or proposing that we only have November referenda coming up in the legislature again.
Now, let me ask the question that has been asked before, I'm sure, at least maybe not in our conversations, but in others as well, about the possibility that we're going to have more referenda votes in the future, and in this case, because of the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on school finances, and in particular, the fact that schools had to close up very early and finish up the school year either by distance learning or by some cases, I guess, not much learning at all.
Well, costs are up and revenues are down. And one of the few remedies that schools have in a situation like that is to go to their voters and ask for additional taxes. You know, the remote learning and the effort required in that and the equipment required for that adds to expense, not to mention if you bring the kids back, all the masks and maybe even additional classroom space somehow, if you're going to spread people out to 6-foot distances, that's going to be expensive. But also, as we may find out today, the governor is trying not to cut the distribution of revenues from the state to the school corporations. But with revenues down at least 15% and maybe more because of the recession, it's going to be very hard it's going to be very hard to say it this way, it's going to be very hard to deliver the full promised aid to school corporations from the state, and that's their major source of revenue. So if it is the case that higher costs and lower revenues cause school corporations to go for referendums, then that's what we'll see. Mm-hmm.
So you think that it's very possible that more school districts will go through the rest of this calendar year and into the new academic year for them, watching the costs very closely as they can do, but they may have to decide, say, next year sometime, perhaps next spring, even as early as then, that they may have to go to the voters and ask for help?
Well, you know, we're going to find out here for the rest of the summer what the situation is. You know, another threat to revenues is what if the kids don't come back? What if a whole lot of parents say, I'm not sending my kid into this group situation with this virus around?
Mm-hmm.
That'll reduce the pupil count, and that, since aid from the state is on a per-pupil basis, that would reduce aid as well. So if school corporations, school boards are looking ahead and saying, you know, the rest of this biennial budget, so we're not going to get as much as promised, and when they write a budget next year, it'll be on the basis of a revenue forecast that'll be based on a recession economy, and so those revenues are not likely to be as much as we'd hoped. I think, especially given the success we had this time, that it may be that a whole lot of school corporations decide to take a chance.
Well, Larry, thank you very much for your thoughts and the information that you have in keeping track of how the public school referenda votes have gone here in this past election. And we'll talk more again, I guess, as we get into the new school year for the youngsters. And we'll have to see how many parents keep their youngsters out of the public schools and continue to teach them at home. And I know that that's what big concern that the directors of the organizations that support the urban school districts in particular are really, really worried about. And we thank you for spending time to talk today with us.
Happy to do it, Chris. Thanks for asking.
Larry DeBoer is a economic professor. He is at Purdue University in West Lafayette, and one of his areas of expertise is closely watching the public school referenda. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There's some controversy that has come up in comments that have been made on social media involving the Gary Fire Department. Let's find out more about them. Tyrone Jackson Jr. is a Gary firefighter, and he is a member of an organization that has been created recently that in turn is supporting black firefighters on the force, and in turn has brought up the comments that in turn have gotten responses from Gary Mayor Jerome Prince and from the fire chief Sean O'Donnell. Mr. Jackson, thank you for joining us on the program today, first off.
Thank you.
Okay. If you will, give us an idea of how this all got underway. What were the concerns that you and perhaps your colleagues with the Black Firefighters Association have about how the Gary Fire Department, number one, is run, and also, too, about how things work over there?
Well, it actually started about last year in November, and everything started when we started it when Chief O'Donnell was actually just the union president at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when we started it, he let us know, in his words, that he was pissed off that we were starting it. And he said he called around and asked people why we were starting it, and Gary is 80% black. He would allow us to start it, even though he didn't agree with it. And we let him know, He don't allow us to do anything. We're starting it. So he's been fighting us ever since he was union president about everything that we do, everything that we did. So then he started doing little stuff, and that's how we got a lot of the vets on our side, because they started seeing him trying to block what we do. We did a shoe giveaway at 21st Century School. One of our colleagues was on shift at the time. We asked, could they bring the engine up there to give out the shoes? So the colleague that donated to some shoes that's in the Black Firefighter Association could participate. And the engineer and the captain was down with it, but they said, you know, Sean O'Donnell's not rocking with you guys right now. We don't really want to get in the middle of it. We know it's not right, but sorry, we just can't do it. So that colleague had to miss out on giving the kids some shoes and stuff that he actually donated money to, actually bought shoes and all that, because of personal reasons of Sean not wanting us to start it. But then once he became chief, it got even worse. He felt like he can actually stop something. So everybody, it's like a tradition in the fire department where everybody wear all different types of shirts, create all different types of shirts, sell them, which is cool. I'm not against it. You could say somewhat ignorant but cool. No meaning behind it. You know, like killer clowns, hitmen with fire hoses and guns, skulls on fire. Stuff of that nature, Irish firefighter shirt. So when we created our shirt, we were selling them. And then he stated, Gary doesn't represent black firefighters, so y'all need to take the Gary logo off. I actually told my colleagues, no, we're not doing it, but they convinced me, let's just do it to see if he approve it. So we took the Gary logo off the front of our shirts and actually created our own shirt to see what he approved it then. He didn't. So we started wearing the shirts anyway. And then he canceled all shirts. He sent out a memo saying no shirts is to be worn, no station shirts, which is station shirts, is shirts representing the station. Like Station 1, which is located by the Railcat Stadium, the station shirt is like a baseball themed shirt because we're next to the baseball stadium. And people can't wear no station shirts, no union shirts, no graphic shirts, none of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that lasted about 2 weeks. No, everybody's just wearing the basic attire. So people, after 2 weeks, people started back wearing all different types of shirts. And we just paid attention to see if they was going to say anything about it. Haven't said anything about it. And that's black, white people, everybody wearing all types of shirts. It's not just one race. All of us wearing all different types of shirts.
Now, Mr. Jackson here, before we go any further, let's let people know, how big is the Gary Fire Department? And in turn, how big is your own organization that you are vice president of, the Black Firefighter Association?
The department is, I think it's about 178 people, mm-hmm. and it's about 15 of us. But it's a lot of people that support what we're doing. So they buy the shirts, like the older firefighters, the vets. A lot of them buy the shirts. So it's only 15 of us, but we got a lot of supporters. A lot of the older guys support us. And it's chapters everywhere, all around the world. We just a chapter that we created in Gary for people in the local area.
Are there any other Black Firefighters Associations around here, if not in this region, at least around the state, that you have a chance to find out more about, to kind of pattern yourselves after?
Yes. The president speaks with the president of the Black Firefighters Association in Indianapolis quite often.
Mm-hmm.
I actually spoke to some guys in Chicago recently about situation we have it now. We kind of ask questions to all the people that's been having a Black Firefighter Association. We ask them, did they have to go through this? What did they do? And all of them stated they had backlash at first. People like Sean O'Donnell stopping it. And I want to make something clear.
Right.
I never said that Sean O'Donnell was racist. What I told him, and it's in the email that I posted, that it's something there that's bothering you, so can you please tell me what it is? It's either that you're intimidated when you see something that's black, that represents black heritage, or you insecure with your own heritage, that you only want to see yours and no one else, or you racist. Can you please tell me which one? So I gave him a choice. Because it's like all the people that represent the Irish, on the department, they wear Irish stuff. They got Irish radio bells. And none of us feel no type of way. Because, black people been representing St. Patrick's Day since forever. Everybody buy Irish shirts on St. Patrick's Day. We don't see nothing. It don't make me feel no type of way in the inside when I see an Irish firefighter shirt or when I see an Irish shirt or a Canadian shirt. It don't make me feel some type of way. But for some reason, for him, when he sees a shirt and it represents black African-American culture, he doesn't like it. Like the side-by-side of the breast cancer shirt that I posted that my classmate, which is the only black female firefighter on Gary's Fire Department, she wanted the design that represented her. So I actually created that design for her because she has dreads. So that's why the lady in the shirt has dreads. She's black. And it just got a hose made into a breast cancer ribbon, which is the same exact shirt of the guy that I showed you, and he had a breast cancer shirt made just like that, but with a white woman on there. And she was told to take hers off, but it's the same shirt. So when he sees shirts and it just represents black people, it makes him feel some type of way. So I'm not saying that he racist, but it's something there. It's an insecurity there. He intimidated something. I don't care what no one says. I see it for myself. Racist is a strong word to put on somebody, so I'm not going to put that word on him. But I gave everybody else to give their opinion. So if everybody else starts saying racist, that's them. I just put the information out there and let everybody say what they think about it. Me personally, I don't think he's insecure about his culture. I don't think he's racist, but I definitely think he's intimidated by black culture. He's cool with black people as long as you just don't bring up exactly who you are. Don't talk about black stuff, black this, black that. Mm-hmm. It makes them uncomfortable, which that, that's a problem if you want to be over a department that's 80% black in a city that's 80% black. It's a problem. If that makes you feel uncomfortable, it's a problem. And that's just how I feel.
Do you think that there's still a chance that you and Chief O'Donnell be able to at least have a chance to see, maybe not see eye to eye, but at least be able to talk about the issues? This is not the last of it.
We can work out the issues, but I spoke with him multiple times on this issue. So if we end up getting worked out, that's cool. But just because of all I've been through with the situation, from November to now, I will never, ever, ever, ever respect the type of man he is. That's just the type of person I am. After you show me who you are, I'm not going to act like you're not that person. I'm just not fake. I can't act like something just happened. I can work with you. We can be coworkers, but we can't. I will never go out with a beer with him like he asked me to. Mm-hmm. I will never chill when I'm outside of work. I will never have a conversation that's not work related with him. That's out the window.
Well, Mr. Jackson, we're gonna have to leave it at that for today, and let's hope that they have a chance to be able to at least have more dialogue and help resolve some of the issues, and certainly at least on one level, and just hope for the best, I guess, as far as certainly your working relationship and in turn the relationship with the rest of City Hall, so to speak, here. And we thank you for spending time to kind of air your views, give us your side of the story. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Tyrone Jackson, Jr. is a Gary firefighter. He's the vice president of the Black Firefighters Association, a new organization compared to the established union set up at the Gary Fire Department. Finding out some of the issues that have come up here and have been brought out in social media lately. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll be with us tomorrow for Reporters Roundtable Thursday, where Mary Frieda with The Times, Carol Carlson of the Post-Tribune will be with us, and we'll bring you a feature from Michael Puente. Hope you'll join us.